The first speaker is Stuart Elden. He is currently a professor of international relations, political theory, geography, or some such combination of these at the University of Warwick in the United Kingdom, which also takes him, because of this special professorship he has, to NYU for a stint in the spring, and to Melbourne, Australia, from which he has just returned. Stuart is a shockingly prolific author. He is not yet caught up with Gary Waller, but given the difference in their ages, he's got time. He's written many books. The first one, Mapping the Present, was on Foucault and Heidegger. He has a big book on the invention of territory, a shorter book on the whole question of territory and terrorism. He is currently at work on finishing up what, when I saw him a few months ago, was a book on Foucault's final decade. It is now two books, one on Foucault's final decade and one on power, as I understand it. And then he'll do his Shakespeare book, on which he has been writing chapters over the last many months to years. So we're very, very lucky to have him visit. This is his fourth visit to Purchase over the years. When I first met him, he was frightfully young. And yeah, he was we're a graduate student, I think. But he's just continued to perform. He's trained in political theory, but has taught in geography departments as well as in political science departments. And as my very abbreviated version of his curriculum vitae should indicate, his interests are broad, interdisciplinary, wide-ranging, and I'm delighted that he will share them with us. Welcome, Stuart Elden.
Thank you, Maurice. It is nice to be back. I come every sort of 3 or 4 years, so I normally see a whole set of different people, apart from faculty, when I come here, but it is nice to be back. So the talk I'm going to give develops some of the ideas from my previous two books on territory. And one of the things I've been thinking about is writing a book about different ways that Shakespeare talks about questions that relate to the idea of territory. And the idea at the moment is to use different plays to exemplify different aspects of the question of territory. But if we're looking simply for the word territory, it's a very rare word in Shakespeare's plays. The word territory in the singular only appears in two plays, and the word territory is only in a handful of plays. So it's an unusual word in Shakespeare, which I think relates to the way that the term is used in political theory and political thought at the time. But I think that the question of territory and related issues, ownership of land, control of land, succession, banishment, these kinds of questions, are fundamental to a whole range of Shakespeare's plays. So what I'm going to talk about today is Richard II, and I'm going to try and pull out some of the legal, but particularly economic, ways in which territory features in this play. Now, Richard II is, of course, a play where banishment is a crucial element. The king, right at the beginning of the play, says that he wants to prevent bloodshed on the land between the feuding noblemen, Bolingbroke and Mowbray, for that our kingdom's earth should not be soiled with that dear blood that it hath fostered. So as a result, he stops their duel and decides to banish them. To Bolingbroke, Duke of Hereford, he speaks, and this is the one instance where the word territory, or territories rather, appears in the play, "Therefore we banish you our territories, you, cousin Hereford, upon pain of life, till twice 5 summers have enriched our fields, shall not re-greet our fair dominions, but tread the stranger paths of banishment." To Mowbray, the Duke of Norfolk, he is told he has a heavier doom, "the dateless limit of thy dear exile." And as the editor of the text has noted, Richard II's own words have a powerful performative aspect here. That as king by divine right, Richard assumes that his words have an almost supernatural power to enact what they refer to. Thus he proposes to Mowbray, "the hopeless word of never to return breathe I against thee upon pain of life." Now the key thing that the king is concerned with in their banishment is that they don't then join together and plot against him in the banishment. But he realizes that these former subjects, as he banishes them from the kingdom, are no longer bound to him. So he asks them to make their final vow, not to embrace each other's love in banishment. They should make that vow not to him as king, but to God. Swear by the duty you owe to God, and therein we banish you yourselves to keep to oath that we administer. And he closes by the instruction not to plot, contrive, or complot any ill against us, our state, our subjects, or our land. But in one respect, he does still hold sway over them, because he responds to John of Gaunt, the grief of John of Gaunt, the father of Bolingbroke, by reducing the term of Bolingbroke's banishment. Thy sad aspect, he says, hath from the number of his banished years plucked four away. Six frozen winters spent, return with welcome home from banishment. So Bolingbroke then recognises that performative aspect of the speech. How long a time lies in one little word. Four lagging winters and four wanton springs end in a word such as the breath of kings. But John of Gaunt is not satisfied by this, because he realises that while the exile has been shortened by 4 years, his own life will not last that long. Little vantage shall I reap thereby, my inch of taper will be burnt and done, and blindfold death not let me see my son. The king suggests, though, that he has many years to live, but Gaunt's reply is telling, not a minute thou cannot give. So the limits of the king's power are evidenced here. He can reduce sentences, he can reduce life, but he cannot grant life. This is, of course, Foucault's point. The privilege of sovereign power was the right to decide life and death. But this was really the right to take life or let live. Only with biopolitics, Foucault suggests, did it become the power to foster life or disallow it to the point of death. That's the only Foucault in this talk. Apologies for those of you who might have an interest in Foucault. Now, with that internal dispute between these two feuding noblemen seemingly resolved, Richard then turns his attention elsewhere, to the rebellion in Ireland. But he worries about the resources that are available to him to deal with this. How is he going to keep this overseas element of his territory, his land of Ireland? So he says, we will ourselves in person to this war, and for our coffers with too great a court and liberal largesse are grown somewhat light. We are enforced to farm our royal realm, the revenue whereof shall furnish us for our affairs in hand. If that comes short, our substitutes at home shall have blank charters, whereto, when they shall know what men are rich, they shall subscribe them for large sums of gold and send them after to supply our wants, for we will make to Ireland presently. So this idea of farming the realm is important. It's a play that's filled with the language of soil, of land, of earth and ground. There's nature imagery throughout the play, the idea of a fruitful kingdom that is producing all of these goods. And it's been suggested that this roots an idea of patriotism, of an attachment to the kingdom in the people. And that comes through in the way that earth, land and ground keep featuring in the language of the play. But what I want to try and suggest is that there's a very strong land politics at stake that goes beyond merely a patriotic attachment to the land. There's what I would call a geopolitical economy, a political economy of earth or of land. The king is condemned for selling these rights and precisely for doing this farming out of the realm. Farming here means to farm out, to lease to tenants, to let the land by lease is the line in the play. The deputies that he has left behind, what he calls here our substitutes at home, the deputies will have blank charters. These are writs that would authorise the crown to extort revenues for unspecified amounts from the affluent noblemen in the kingdom. The charters would have the names and the amounts inscribed, or here subscribed, to them. And the shift in focus for Richard in relation to John of Gaunt is especially clear when he hears of Gaunt's illness. Now put it, God, in the physician's mind to help him to his grave immediately. The lining of his coffers, the wealth that he has, shall make coats to deck our soldiers for these Irish wars. Come, gentlemen, let's all go visit him. Pray God we may make haste and come too late. Now, this is the idea then that he can take this money, he can take the money, the revenues from one of his rich noblemen in the kingdom, and use this as the revenue that will fund the wars that he wants to pursue overseas to keep the territory of Ireland. But Gaunt, of course, has the life left in him to make that very powerful, very famous speech where he both praises the land and deplores what it has become. I'm not going to read the whole speech. But you know this speech, the royal throne of kings, the sceptred isle, this earth of majesty, this seat of Mars, this other Eden demi-paradise, this fortress built by nature for herself against infection and the hand of war, and it carries on that line. This happy breed of men, this little world, this precious stone set in the silver sea, which served in the office of a wall or as a moat defensive to a house against the envy of less happier lands. So that's all the positive praise of England, the attachment to a particular place, its geographical location. This blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England, this land of such dear souls, this dear, dear land, dear for her reputation through the world, is now leased out. I die pronouncing it like to a tenement or pelting farm. And he carries on with this way of simultaneously praising England for all of the things that it has to do with the particular geography of its being an island kingdom surrounded by water. This gives us a particular setting and security, but the watery Neptune is now bound in with shame, with inky blots and rotten parchment bonds, these charters or these treaties that have been used to try and economically make the most of this, to farm this out, to gain the revenue from it. That England, that was wont to conquer others, has made a shameful conquest of itself. Would the scandal vanish with my life, and happy then my ensuing death. So Gaunt then says, when he encounters the king doesn't come too soon, too late as he sees it, when Gaunt is still alive, so Gaunt is able to confront him for these things. He says, thy deathbed is no lesser than thy land, wherein thou liest in reputation sick. And then the punning line, a thousand flatterers sit within thy crown, whose compass is no bigger than thy head, and yet encaged in so small a verge, the waste is no whit lesser than thy land. Now there's obviously a land element there, there's a kind of geocorporeal alongside the geopolitical in this relation, but the compass as the circumference that the real jurisdiction of the king is being suggested is extending no further than the king's physical body rather than throughout the whole kingdom he's supposed to be the king of. It's within the space enclosed by his crown that the verge, another limit or demarcation of a border. But waste is an interesting thing here. Of course, it's playing on the idea of waste as in spoil or something that is abandoned or not used, but also the physical waste around the body as a particular circumference or a verge. But it also relates very explicitly to law and economic law about property. One of the things you'll find in a clause on rented property is that you should not do damage to it, and the word that they use, you should not damage the rented property, you should not spoil it. The word that is often used there is this idea of waste, either through deliberate action or through neglect. And then Gaunt turns to the king, why, cousin, wert thou regent of the world, it were a shame to let this land by lease. But for thy world enjoying but this land, is it not more shame to shame it so? Landlord of England art thou now, not king. Thy state of law is bondslave to the law. So it's this connection to a kind of a feudal relation, that he is no longer the king of England in all of the ways that that might be understood, but he is much more narrowly the landlord, the land owner, the land regulator, the land controller, and that he's making the most of this realm that should be something that is used for inheritance, to lease it out, to gain these revenues from it. I'm going to move over some of these points, but this particular one seems to me important. There's this very dismissive moment, so that when Gaunt dies, the king says, the ripest fruit first falls, and so doth he. His time is spent, our pilgrimage must be. So much for that, and in those very short lines dismisses all of the past and with Gaunt. Now, he says, for our Irish wars. And so there's the colonial war of subjugation against the feuding people within the kingdom, but it's the importance that I'm trying to stress here between the idea of preserving the territory of Ireland, but the means to do that, that the enabling the army, funding the army, giving them the clothes and the weapons that they need, through these economic extractions from the noblemen within the kingdom. So the stress in the line here, the plate, coin, revenues and movables whereof our uncle Gaunt did stand possessed. Now that becomes a recurrent theme throughout the play, because with Gaunt's death, this inheritance should pass to Henry Bolingbroke. Bolingbroke, of course, at this time has been exiled from the kingdom. But he's robbed him not simply of his ability to live within the territory of England, but he has also robbed him of the lands and the title that he should inherit from Gaunt. He's robbed him not merely of an inheritance in a narrow sense, but he also breaks the ideal of inheritance, which is the very basis that he, Richard II, owns the crown of England. Soon after Gaunt dies, Northumberland declares, "Well, lords, the Duke of Lancaster is dead." Ross replies, "And living too, for now his son, i.e. Bolingbroke in exile, is Duke." Willoughby adds in, "No, barely in title, but not in revenues." And Northumberland responds, "Richly in both, justice had her right." So Richard is creating a very legitimate grievance in Bolingbroke beyond merely the exile for those 6 years that he'd reduced his sentence to. When Bolingbroke comes back at the head of the army, he does so while Richard is away putting down the Irish rebellion. But part of the reason that Richard has created the grievance in Bolingbroke, rather than simply the exile, but dispossessing him of the lands and his title, this is the problem that Bolingbroke comes back for. He comes back to reclaim that title and the inheritance of lands that Richard has taken from him. And there are various moments in the play where this kind of economic set of questions or this economic set of disputes come back in. So you have the line here about the different ways in which the nobles are being dispossessed of their property, the grievous taxes, the daily new exactions, blanks, benevolences, and I what not what. I have no idea what will come up as the next set of things that he will do, but these are particular blank charters, so legal documents, benevolences, which were understood as forced loans, of trying to extract value from the noblemen within the country. And the argument is that the people that have been doing this on Richard's behalf, while Richard has been away, the Earl of Wiltshire hath the realm in farm. So there's continual stress on the idea of farming out the realm, extracting the economic benefit from it. So Richard, while he wants to keep Ireland as territory under English sovereignty, the means by which he tries to achieve this raises the threat to sovereignty back in England itself. And it's precisely because of the use of that territory, the farming it out, the use of it as land, territory being reduced merely to land in that sense. Now, throughout the play, there's all sorts of moments when agricultural language comes up. There's the language around pests being used to mirror the political challenges. So Bushy, Bagot and their accomplices, the caterpillars of the Commonwealth, which I have sworn to weed and pluck away. And this continues when he condemns them to death. "Whilst you have fed upon my signories, displaced my parks and felled my forest woods." You've used the lands that I own for purposes that I don't think as king are legitimate for that. And the use of language of earth comes back time and again within the play. I said how important that was, but for me it's within this geopolitical economy, a political economy of land, rather than simply a kind of a nationalism sense of it. So when Richard returns from Ireland, he talks about, and there's a whole set of passages where he keeps talking about my earth, I'm back in my land, my territory, we might say, about how the king has returned back to England itself. Again, I'm not going to read the whole passage here, but a whole set of images around that idea of earth, of groundedness in a particular location. And if I had more time, I'd go on to the language of return from banishment and how Bolingbroke situates his relation to the land when he comes back from that exile that he has been expelled into. But I just want to underline on that the importance of how Bolingbroke claims that he is just, saying that he will see the king and even at his feet to lay my arms and power, that he will surrender the fact that he is leading an army back, provided that my banishment is repealed and the lands restored again be freely granted. In other words, he wants to be back in a particular place, to not have that sentence of banishment, but also to gain back the land that he has been dispossessed at the death of his father. So an expulsion from the territory and the theft of the land are the dual aspects of Bolingbroke's grievance. The advantage is, and this goes right back to the opening scene with the idea of preventing the bloodshed between the feuding noblemen by banishing them, it's this idea of the soil, the earth of England being soaked with the blood of those that will die over this fight. Bolingbroke's mere presence in the kingdom is treason. He is a body out of place. It's within the term of his banishment and he has come back into the kingdom. Richard states that very explicitly. "Tell Bolingbroke, for you methinks he stands, that every stride he makes upon my land is dangerous treason." And again, this idea of the blood that will soak into the soil as a result of the contest that is going to have to take place within this. Bolingbroke, though, keeps contending that he has only come back to gain his title and his lands. But of course, he ends up with Richard's title and Richard's lands, the crown and the kingdom, as a result of his actions. The king, of course, tries to reconcile himself to this. Say, is my kingdom lost? Why, 'twas my care, and what loss it is to be rid of care. But compared to the power of the opening scene, where every proclamation that the king made had that performative aspect of turning things into the reality, we now see, at the end of the play, Richard's late linguistic impotence. O God, that ere this tongue of mine that laid the sentence of dread banishment on yon proud man should take it off again with words of sooth. And he also makes a list of the trades that he is now willing to countenance in order to keep hold of at least something of his previous status. And I'm not going to read the whole scene, but there's this lovely passage where he says all of the things that he will give in terms of his being a king for the poverty that he's willing to endure, as long as the suggestion is that he can keep his life at least for some time. So a kind of an exchange economy now, as opposed to the earlier economy where he was trying to gain all the revenues from the kingdom. But again, you can see this in the last lines of the passage here, our size and they shall lodge the summer corn and make a dearth in this revolting land. So the fertile, productive land that was being praised so much at the beginning is now this idea of you will try and deny all of that, you will create a famine, you will create a problem within the kingdom and this lack of the productive fertility within the land. Now, a whole range of passages where they talk about these kinds of questions, thinking about the idea of the enemy coming back and measuring our confines, marching around the borders of the kingdom with such peaceful steps, the threat to the territory, the threat of the conquest of the territory, and the overthrow of Richard as the king with who will become Henry IV. And Richard, and again, I'm not going to read all of these passages, but again, you can see a whole set of relations to being tied to the ground, to the soil of the kingdom. Can we bequeath, save our deposed bodies to the ground? Our lands, our lives, and all are Bolingbroke's. All of this has now been turned over to Bolingbroke. Bolingbroke has supplanted him as the king and has become the future Henry IV. And then in one of their final exchanges, Richard demurs when Bolingbroke kneels. Fair cousin, he says, you debase your princely knee to make the base earth proud with kissing it. But Bolingbroke states, my gracious lord, I come but for mine own. To which Richard replies, your own is yours, and I am yours and all. All of this is now being transferred over to Bolingbroke. Now, in a longer version, I try and think through how this plays out in the gardener's scene around that agricultural language of the fertility of the soil and so on. But I'm going to turn in conclusion towards some of the last lines, where they talk again about this idea of the blood of England that shall manure the ground and future ages groan for this foul act. And then in the last lines of this passage, oh, if you raise this house against this house, it will the woefulness division prove that ever fell upon this cursed earth. But the stress of the kingdom, the stress of the responsibility that came with that, is something that Richard occasionally tries to talk away and say that he's not too sorry to be losing this. It's the talk of the tired majesty, of resigning the kingly rank or throne, of handing the state and the crown from Richard to Bolingbroke. And then, again, an economic set of questions around there in one of these passages, one of the king's last passages from the play. My manors, rents, revenues I forego, my acts, decrees and statutes I deny. The economic and the legal also being surrendered at that point of transferring. And ends by suggesting, long may thou live in Richard's seat to sit, and soon lie Richard in an earthy pit. At least in death the king will be returned to the soil, to the ground of the kingdom. So he surrenders his crown and his wealth, but Northumberland suggests that the deposed king needs to sign confessions to his various crimes. No more but that you read these accusations and these grievous crimes committed by your person and your followers against the state and profit of this land, that by confessing them, the souls of men may deem that you are worthily deposed. We need to find a legal justification for why you were deposed, and it is precisely around this crimes committed against the state and profit of this land. Again, that geographical earthy sense. And Richard then, in some of the final lines, for I have given here my soul's consent to undeck the pompous body of a king, made glory base and sovereignty a slave, proud majesty a subject, state a peasant, moving from the elevated position of glory to the baseness, from sovereignty to a slave, from majesty to a subject, but crucially, from the state to a peasant, almost a return back to an earlier feudal set of relations, back to an agricultural economy rather than the emerging economy of the time in which at least the play is written. And then finally, the return of the question of banishment. In two of the final lines of the play, King Henry IV, the former Bolingbroke, now that he is now king, looks for a redemption for what he has done, and it's a redemption that he too seeks through geography, through the voluntary exile of pilgrimage. If he had been exiled involuntarily at the beginning of the play, an exile from which the return was some deferred point in the future, pilgrimage is an exile that is voluntary and that you choose the own date of your return. Says Henry IV now, "I'll make a voyage to the Holy Land to wash this blood off from my guilty hand," which of course becomes an issue at the beginning of Henry IV, Part 1. I think I'll save some of my concluding thoughts for our later discussion, unless you think I have 3 or 4 more minutes?
Sure.
Okay. So for me, Shakespeare is interesting around these questions precisely because of the time that he's writing. End of the 16th and beginning of the 17th century, which for me is the time when the modern conception of sovereign territory is really beginning to emerge within political thought, political practice of the time. For me, Shakespeare is in an interesting position because he's got, in a sense, an eye forward and an eye back. He's able to open up some of the ambiguities and tensions and limits of the way that we understand territory-sovereignty relations today. And a number of Shakespeare's plays for me open up different aspects of these questions. We could look at it in terms of the colonial, not simply through The Tempest, although of course that play is around these kind of questions, but the colonial relation to territory, territory overseas, comes through for me in other plays, in Antony and Cleopatra, in Pericles, and certainly in Othello. The theme of what might lie outside of territory comes through in, for me, Titus Andronicus and As You Like It. But in his own England at the time that he's writing, so late 16th, early 17th century, the dominant form of political power is an absolute monarchy conducted in a space that at Shakespeare's time was relatively ordered and bordered. But its recent past, which Shakespeare, of course, explores in the history plays, was anything but straightforward and understood in those ways. Richard II, for me, as I've suggested, around these political economies of land and the politics of banishment. There's important contemporary resonances of many of Shakespeare's history plays. Richard II, though, is an interesting one in relation to Queen Elizabeth. Elizabeth is said to have remarked at one point, "Know that I am Richard II. Don't you realise this? That I am likely to be dispossessed in the same way that Richard was." And there's a story that a performance of Richard II was made shortly before the failed attempt to depose Elizabeth by the Earl of Essex. You can see a number of these territorial or kind of geographical issues, political geographical issues, in a range of other plays. Coriolanus, that we're about to hear from, has to me a whole set of issues around the bodies and the geocorporeality of understanding the kingdom, but also the bodies of the political leaders within it. I think there's a wider geopolitical framing around Hamlet that often gets written out or produced out in terms of how it's staged. We tend to think of Hamlet as this kind of enclosed court politics within the court of Elsinore. I try and produce a reading that says, look at the way that Denmark is surrounded by those powerful neighbours of Norway and Poland, and how can we read that story within that much wider geopolitical frame? And a whole range of ways in which the plays open up those kinds of questions. We were just talking before the session about the legal disputes over land that are important in the opening scene of Henry V, for example. There's a passage in Henry IV, Part 1, where they're dividing up the land of the kingdom. So Henry IV might take the crown from Richard II, but Henry IV is still having to face off a number of threats to his own power as king. And in Henry IV, Part 1, there's a division of the map of the kingdom, how they will divide up the land after Henry is dispossessed. What's interesting for me in that scene is that although they decide that they are going to divide up the kingdom by the rivers Severn and the rivers Trent, Hotspur disputes this because he says the river's running in the wrong direction. See how it comes me cranking in and cuts me off the best of all my land. It doesn't run in the way that we want it to. And then they actually seriously discuss digging a new trench to make the river flow in a different direction, to make the distribution of land on either side of the river more equitable. So for me then, and this is why I'm interested in Shakespeare in relation to my earlier interest in territory, Shakespeare helps us to understand a multiple way or multiple set of ways in which we might understand the question of territory, and that conceptually historically and politically. Thank you.